Right. So today we're diving into a case. It's called The Antelope. It's from 1825.
In 1825, yeah.
And it might seem like, oh, Supreme Court case from, almost 200 years ago. But this one, the ripples, the legal ripples from it are still felt today, especially when we talk about international law and even, the concept of freedom itself. So what is it about the antelope that makes it so important even now, 2 centuries later?
Well, the antelope, it just throws us right into this like moral and legal whirlwind of this young America that's grappling with slavery, international relations, and these just really thorny questions about freedom. Like, what does it actually mean?
And I think what makes this case even more fascinating is that it all starts with, well, you could say a pirate ship or something pretty close to it.
Close to it.
So we've got this ship called the Arriganta. It's a Baltimore ship. And it starts out as a regular merchant vessel, but then it gets this privateer's license. So it basically becomes like a legally sanctioned pirate, right? It can just go around and raid other ships off the coast of Africa. So set the scene for us. Like, what was happening on the high seas back then?
Oh man, it was brutal to really grasp like the gravity of it all. We have to remember what was going on. So the Arriganta, they weren't just plundering random ships. They were targeting the ships that were part of the transatlantic slave trade. Thousands upon thousands of Africans ripped from their homes, enduring these horrific conditions, just forced into a life of servitude in the Americas.
So the Arriganta intercepts these slave ships, takes the enslaved Africans on board, and then there's a plot twist. The Arriganta gets shipwrecked. The crew and the captured Africans end up being transferred to another ship, the now infamous Antelope.
And that's where things get really, really interesting. Legally explosive, you could say. Because the Antelope gets caught. Not by another pirate ship, but by a U.S. revenue cutter near Florida. And the seemingly mundane event, it just sets off this international legal battle.
Okay, wait. So how does a shipwreck off the coast of Florida turn into this Supreme Court showdown?
So here's where all these different legal systems collide.
Okay.
You have Spain and Portugal coming in,
Right.
saying, "Hold on, those enslaved Africans on the Antelope, those are ours. Give them back.
Right.
They're operating under their own laws," where the slave trade was still legal.
But at the same time, the U.S. is already having its own internal debates about slavery, and there are laws being passed against the slave trade. So you have this clash of legal perspectives, right? It's like, whose laws apply on the high seas? And can the U.S. assert its own anti-slave trade laws in a situation like this?
Exactly. And all of this lands at the feet of Chief Justice John Marshall,
Of course, yeah.
who, as I'm sure many of our listeners know, this giant of constitutional law. I mean, he shapes so much of how we understand American law, even today. But in the Antelope case, he's faced with this almost impossible dilemma.
So what does he do? Does he basically say, look, slavery is awful, but we have to respect what other countries are doing?
Well, his ruling is it's far more nuanced than that. He acknowledges the horrors of slavery, but he ultimately feels bound by these principles of international law as they existed at the time.
All right, help me out here. What exactly does international law have to do with this? And how does it factor into Marshall's decision?
Okay, so the key concept here is comity. Essentially, it means that nations, they kind of agree to respect each other's laws and judicial decisions, even when they might disagree with them. And Marshall, he really grapples with this in his ruling. He even states, no nation can rightfully impose a rule on another.
So he's saying the U.S. can't just force its views about slavery on Spain and Portugal, even if those views are evolving and changing.
At that time, international law, it functioned more like the set of mutual agreements, not like a universal set of rules that everyone had to follow. Marshall, even if he personally opposed slavery, he felt bound by this existing system of international relations.
Okay, but then doesn't that just mean that the enslaved Africans are out of luck?
Well, not entirely.
Yeah.
Here's where Marshall throws a bit of a curveball. He insists on rock-solid evidence to prove ownership of the enslaved Africans.
Oh, interesting.
He's not just going to take Spain and Portugal's word for it.
So he's basically saying, prove it.
Right.
Like, show me the receipts.
Yeah, yeah.
The documentation.
The documentation.
That these people are actually your property under the law.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting.
It is. And this demand for evidence, it ends up having a significant impact on the case. Okay.
So Spain, they actually had the paperwork.
Oh, wow.
Showing that they had legally acquired at least some of the Africans under Spanish law.
Yeah.
So they got 93 people back.
Wow. Okay, so Spain has their paperwork. What about Portugal? Did they get their claim to ownership recognized?
This is where things get even more interesting. Portugal, they showed up empty-handed.
Really?
No paperwork, nothing.
Wow.
To really back up their claim.
Hmm.
So their case, you could say, it sank without a trace.
It's incredible to think that, you know, a case about human beings, the whole thing could just hinge on something like paperwork.
Right.
But I guess that's the power of legal precedent.
It absolutely is. And even though Marshall's ruling, it was largely seen as a victory for Spain and Portugal, his insistence on evidence had this really fascinating unintended consequence.
Okay.
It introduced this idea that even in cases involving the slave trade, you couldn't just claim ownership of another human being without concrete proof. So it's like Marshall created this tiny crack in the legal armor that protected slavery, even if he didn't explicitly intend to do so.
That's a great way to put it. And it's this subtle but significant legal shift
that
would later be used to challenge slavery in other cases.
You mentioned earlier that the Antelope case didn't end the debate on slavery. Were there other cases that picked up where the Antelope left off?
Definitely. Take the Amistad case, for instance.
Okay.
That happened in 1841. And it also centered on enslaved Africans who revolted on a ship.
Right.
The Amistad case, it actually built upon the principles established in the Antelope.
Okay.
Especially this idea of requiring evidence of ownership.
Right.
And the broader question of whether a person could be considered property under international law.
It's almost like a legal ripple effect, right?
Yeah.
What started as a seemingly minor detail in the Antelope case, this focus on documentation.
Right.
It becomes this much bigger issue in later cases.
Exactly. And that's what makes legal history so compelling. These seemingly isolated events, they can actually have these long-reaching consequences, influencing how future cases are argued and decided.
So we have these two cases, the Antelope and the Amistad, both highlighting the complexities of slavery. You know, in this world where international law often clashed with changing moral standards.
Yeah.
But what about the human side of this story?
That's something that often gets lost in the legal back and forth.
Right.
We can't forget that at the heart of these cases were real people.
Yeah.
Whose lives were hanging in the balance.
Right.
You know, these were individuals.
Yeah.
Who had families, cultures, dreams.
Yeah.
And who were being treated as mere commodities.
It's hard to even fathom that, you know, just a couple centuries ago, people were arguing over whether another human being could be considered property.
Right.
It makes you really appreciate how far we've come as a society.
It does. But it also reminds us that the fight for human rights, it's never truly over. You know, we still see echoes of these legal and moral battles playing out today in discussions about immigration, refugees, human trafficking, you know.
It's a sobering thought. We might not be dealing with chattel slavery anymore.
Yeah.
But there are still so many forms of exploitation.
Yeah.
Injustice.
Yeah.
That we're grappling with. So how do we learn from cases like the Antelope?
Yeah.
And apply those lessons to the challenges we face today?
Well, one of the key takeaways, for me at least, is that legal systems, while they might seem rigid, they're constantly evolving. Mm. There's always room for reinterpretation, for pushing boundaries, for challenging the status quo.
And for fighting for what's right.
Absolutely.
Even when it seems like an uphill battle.
Absolutely. The Antelope case, it reminds us that even these seemingly small legal victories, like requiring evidence of ownership, they can create these cracks in a system that seems unbreakable.
Right.
And those cracks, over time, they can lead to significant change.
So it's about recognizing those small victories.
Yeah.
Learning from them.
Yeah.
Using them as stepping stones.
Yeah.
Toward a more just world.
Exactly.
But here's something I've always wondered. How could brilliant legal minds like John Marshall, who is considered one of the greatest jurists in American history, how could he not see the inherent injustice of slavery.
Right.
Did he really believe that upholding international comedy was more important than basic human rights?
That's a question that historians and legal scholars continue to debate.
I mean, it's so easy to look back, right, and judge historical figures based on our modern understanding of morality and things like that.
Yeah. It's so easy to just kind of, you know, sit back and point fingers and be like, oh, they should have known better.
Right. But I guess it's important to try to understand, you know, the context
they
were operating in, Trey.
Absolutely. Like, we forget, during Marshall's time, slavery, it was deeply woven into the fabric of society.
Yeah.
Not just in the U.S., but globally.
Yeah, yeah.
And even individuals who might have personally opposed it, they were working within a system that made challenging slavery incredibly difficult.
So they were trapped, in a sense, in this legal and social framework that just made it hard to even envision a world without slavery.
Yeah, in many ways, yes. But it's also important to remember that even within that framework, there was still room for individual choices,
right,
for interpretations of the law, for pushing boundaries. And those choices, as we've seen with the antelope, they could have these ripple effects.
Right.
That extended far beyond that immediate situation.
It makes you think about the choices we're making today.
Yeah.
You know, the laws we're upholding or challenging.
Yeah.
And how those might be viewed, you know, by future generations.
Oh, absolutely. We are all products of our time, right?
Right.
Shaped by the prevailing norms and beliefs of our society. But it's our responsibility to critically examine those norms.
Yeah.
To question the systems we operate in.
Right.
And to fight for a more just and equitable world.
So circling back to the antelope, I'm curious, you know, what was the lasting impact of this case? Did it ultimately help advance the cause of abolition, or did it reinforce that legal status quo that protected slavery?
You know, the antelope case, it's a great example of how legal history is rarely black and white. Uh-huh. You know, it's a story of compromises, unintended consequences, subtle shifts that would later pave the way for more substantial change.
Right.
The case itself, it might not have directly led to the abolition of slavery, but it did contribute to this growing body of legal precedent that would be used to challenge the legitimacy of slavery in the years to come.
So would you say that the antelope is more of a story of delayed justice rather than denied justice?
I think it's more complex than that. It's a reflection of a particular moment in history, a time when the world was grappling with these really fundamental questions about human rights, what it truly meant to be free. The case, it highlights these inherent tensions between national sovereignty, international law, and the evolving moral conscience of a nation.
It's fascinating how, you know, a case from 1825 can still raise these thought-provoking questions, offer insights into contemporary challenges. For our listeners who want to go even deeper into this case, I highly recommend checking out John Marshall's original writing.
Oh, yeah.
His language, his grappling with the moral dilemma of slavery, it's incredibly insightful.
It's a reminder that even these towering figures like John Marshall, who shaped so much of American law, they were still wrestling with the complexities of their time.
Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up our deep dive into the antelope case. It's a story that's both fascinating and challenging.
Yeah.
Reminding us that legal history, it's full of these twists and turns and unintended consequences that continue to shape our world today.
Absolutely. And it's a story that encourages us, right?
Yeah.
To keep asking those tough questions,
yeah,
keep pushing for a more just world, and keep learning from the legal battles of the past.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us on this journey through legal history. Until next time, keep questioning, keep exploring, and keep diving deep.